Welcome, everybody, to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the...
Hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio 1, and welcome to the show, where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Our very special guest today is Dennis LeCourriere, the legendary lead singer, guitarist, and songwriter for Dr. Hook. Dr. Hook was an internationally recognizable household name throughout the 70s and 80s, and in many territories throughout the world, it retains that standing to this day. Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show did its farewell tour with Dennis on vocals in the late 80s, but it was just the beginning of what he has since accomplished in his long and colorful career. The LeCourriere penned songs have been recorded and performed by artists such as Helen Reddy, Lou Rawls, B.J. Thomas, Olivia Newton-John, Southside Johnny, Willie Nelson, and Bob Dylan. As a solo artist, LeCourriere has played at countless prestigious venues like Festival Hall in Melbourne, Royal Concert Hall in Glasgow, the Liverpool Philharmonic, and festivals including the UK's Glastonbury, and has released three critically acclaimed albums. Not for 30 years have the massive hits of Dr. Hook been sung and played live by a band worthy of that title until now. Following the success of the Universal release, Dr. Hook Timeless, in the UK, New Zealand, and Australia, Dennis LeCourriere, who from the very beginnings of Dr. Hook to the height of their success, was the unmistakable voice of the band's biggest hits and best-loved songs, such as Sylvia's Mother, cover of Rolling Stone, Only 16, A Little Bit More, If Not You, Sharing the Night Together, Better Love Next Time, Sexy Eyes, When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman, Years From Now, and so many, many more. And they're touring the world with an incredibly talented band of musicians and singers playing all of the hits. This is something that LeCourriere has done since his Dr. Hook farewell tour in 1985. In fact, never before have these songs been recreated live to sound just as they did when they were originally recorded in the famous Nashville Muscle Shoals Studios with some of the best session musicians in the world. Possessing one of the most recognizable voices in popular music, Dennis LeCourriere and the band have already performed sellout shows in New Zealand, Australia, and the UK, and will be bringing this unique experience to the rest of the world. Dennis says, I know that people love the Dr. Hook sound on those original recordings, and that's why we're bringing back to them just the way they remember it and want to hear it performed live. Dr. Hook, starring Dennis LeCourriere, the Timeless World Tour is the show Dr. Hook fans have been waiting for. It is my great pleasure to welcome the legendary Dennis LeCourriere to the Ray Shasho Show. Welcome, Dennis.
Welcome, Ray. Man, I don't know what else I'm going to say. You know, I should just say, thank you very much. That sounds like I wrote it. And and I should go. No, it's cool, man. It's really nice. It's nice to be on your show. And it's nice to be talking to America because I haven't been there in a while. I've been living in the UK for like the last 14 years. And, you know, I'm looking to get hooked back there. You know what I mean? Let me start at the end of what you just said, okay, about the material
sure.
being played the way it's supposed to sound.
Okay.
After the farewell tour in 85, I kind of just went and did other things because I was like in my mid-30s and Hook had a good run and people was talking to me talking to me about who I used to be already. And I thought,
right.
you know, I really need to give this a rest. I don't want to wind up hating this thing that was such an important part of my life. I don't want to resent it. I want to love it. So I went and I did, like you said, some songwriting for others, and I I did some acting, and you know, I did a lot of solo touring, and there were always hook songs in the show. I mean, I did a lot of shows with just me and a couple of guitars, and 40 years worth of songs, and some of them were new that I wrote last night, and some of them were on my solo albums, and a good bit of them were the hook things, but they were a guy singing a song with a guitar, even if it was a big hit. Now you had a guy singing you the song that we first heard or first wrote, very simply, before we turned it into a big bells and whistles hit, you know. So I was kind of on the ground for a long time, and I put a couple of bands together here and there, but I mostly did that singer-songwriter journeyman thing, you know, around the world, Australia, and I just kind of did that. And then you mentioned the Timeless album, and I put that out in 2014. I put it together for Universal Music Group, who they kind of wound up with the catalog. They acquired the catalog, and they had all the songs, and they asked me if I would help them put an album together, and I said yeah, and they wanted two CDs, 40 tracks, and so I had to pretty much listen to all of everything we'd ever done, you know, after a long while, and you know, to varying degrees, I thought, no, that could have been better, just like I probably thought it could have been better then. Sometimes you miss something in the studio, but for the most part, I was really pleased with the fact that Hook's input wasn't the same song over and over. Some of it was ballads, and some of it was, you know, funny, and some of it was rock and roll with horns, and some of it had steel guitars. And I thought, you know, I was trying to sequence these CDs, and part of my brain started thinking in sequence, this would make a great show. And when the album came out here and in the UK and in New Zealand and Australia, it went top 10, top 20, and people started talking to me about Hook, just like they always have. And so I've arrived here again over the last couple of years, and as much as I shied away from it, I kind of think it's almost, if it's going to be done, it needs to be done now. Because you get to a certain point in your life, and you don't go, yeah, I'll do that in 5 years. You go, really, will I? No, I think I'll do that in 5 minutes. That's why, you know, you emailed me yesterday and said you want to do the interview, and I said, absolutely, how about tomorrow?
How about tomorrow? We did it.
yeah, so, I mean, I didn't mean to just monopolize all that time, but that kind of brings me up to where I am right now, which is...
Right.
It's Dr. Hook, and the band that I have is brilliant. And, you know, I'm the only original member. I mean, four of the guys have passed away, so, you know, any Hook reunion would have to start with a seance, you know what I mean? You know, some of my friends are gone, you know.
Yeah.
But the music is what people talk to me about now, because there are younger people that don't even know what we used to look like. They just know the music. It's on their iPod. You know, they've heard it. And they talk to me about the music. And so short of me promising everybody I'm in my 30s and everybody's alive, I'm the singer on mostly all this stuff, and I can put a band together and go out and recreate this sound. And it seems to be one people like. And so, you know, I told the musical director of the band, I said, you know, this music is like a sense memory to people. You know, it's like smelling apple pie and remembering your mom's house. I said, so pretty much we better use mom's recipe here. You know, this can't, well, you know what I mean? It can't sound like, oh, I've been singing this for 40 years and I'm so bored with it. We're going to do the Latvian folk version of it, you know? And so this stuff now, and it's a joy. I have to tell you, it's really a joy after years of recreating this stuff with just a guitar. It's lovely to go on stage and have all those harmonies be there and all the bits, all those little bits, you know, the apple pie. And so it's been cool, and I'm really into it now, and I'd love to get it back to the States. You know, I really would.
That'll be awesome. You know, it's amazing how the overseas market tends to be more faithful to certain bands and genres than the U.S., and that's happened to a lot of bands. You know, like I could name, you know, Status Quo, Golden Earring. And these are all bands that are still very big, you know, over in the overseas market. I talked to Susie Quattro, who lives in England as well, and she's from Michigan originally. but she's still huge over there, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, they've got a different feeling, you know? They really respect
I'll tell you exactly what it is, because it's perplexed me for a long time, too, but it's dawned on me over the years. It's big, man. The streets are big, you know. I always make the joke that to be a popular, to be a national success in America, you have to set yourself on fire in New York and pray that somebody smells smoke in Los Angeles, you know, because otherwise you're regional. You're regional. Yeah. Even with Hook, you know, we'd come over to UK. We'd do a UK tour, England, Ireland, Scotland. We'd go to Australia. We'd do 15 dates, and we'd pop over to New Zealand. We'd do 10. We go to Scandinavia. Navy, we do 15. We go to Germany, we do. You go to America, you do eight dates in Texas.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, you'd play the East Coast.
True. True.
And nobody else would know you were there. I mean, the only way you can do, people say to me all the time, you're going to do an American tour? The only people that do American tours are stadium bands.
Yeah,
they play six or seven stadiums across America, and 40 million people come to see them, and they go somewhere else.
Exactly,
I mean, the only reason I haven't been in America is because I could really come there for 3 months, and most of you guys wouldn't know I was there. And it's just like that. It's just like that. Now,
I never thought
one
about
of the things,
that before.
Yes, and one of the things that was cool about Hook was that, and lucky for us, is that we had records on the radio. And that helped you be a little more national, you know. But we never did an American tour as such, ever. Even at the height of our success, we did a lot of gigs.
That's
but
true.
We never were going across America. I mean, for the first 5 years of our career, we were in two rent-a-cars, you know. And then we got a coach. We rented a bus, you know. We had a coach. But we spent a lot of time elsewhere. One, because we were popular and we always had a hit record somewhere. It was like we could pretty much follow the charts, you know, and they'd go, we want you here now. And then we'd be in Australia and they'd go, this is great. And then somebody would say, they're forgetting about you over in the UK. And you'd go, oh. And we were, I mean, we were literally on the road about 280 days a year, Hook, because I'm talking pre-video.
Now
you can send a short film. Everybody sees you. If they like your haircut, they like your cheekbones, they invite you to do a tour. You know, but back then, if they wanted to see you, you did your laundry, you packed your suitcase, and you showed up.
And
we showed up everywhere. You know, we were a working band.
You guys, in the early days, though, you shared the stage with rock royalty, man. You guys, you played with Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Steve Miller, John Mayall, Kiss. Zappa, Edgar Winter, even James Brown in a festival. So.
And, you know, I don't know if we belonged everywhere or none of those places. Seriously, because we did, like you said, we played with Frank Zappa. We opened for Zappa. We played Stevie Wonder. I mean, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer was our first big tour after being a bar band where we used to play to drunks and they'd come up and say, you know any country music? And we'd say, yes, sir, we do now. Just don't hit me. You know? And now we were opening for Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and they were British band, and their sound sounded like World War III was about to happen, and we were sewing our jeans together before the show, you know? I mean, so we really did all... Hey, I'll tell you how stupid it got. We one time headlined 24 hours of soul music at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, Texas, because the promoter made a mistake and thought we were Dr. John.
Oh, my goodness.
And just before we went on, you know, after Albert King and the Staple Singers, and we were going, why are we here? The promoter came back and said, have a good show, Dr. John. And we thought, my God. And we went out and we sang Sylvia's Mother to an R&B crowd, and they liked us.
That's
Maybe
funny.
They pitied us, but we got out of there, you know. So we did a little bit of all of it, man. Touring was... I wonder about acts now, you know. I you know, there are a lot of bands still on the ground touring, but when you see things like the X Factor and you know, and they make some poor kid feel like a superstar for 14 weeks and then they tell him to shut up and go home. it's weird. It's weird, you know. I don't mind the talent shows where it's a dog act against a magician. But when it's singer against singer, we got a gladiator arena happening here, man. It's just not fair.
Exactly.
You know, but that's, what am I going to, because now that I've said that to you, it's all going to change.
I know, probably.
It's going to stay right where it is, man. As soon as somebody makes money on something, it ain't
true.
Disappearing anywhere.
It's true. You know? It's true. I know. You guys. I guess you got your first big break when you were you played in the movie Harry Kellerman and Why Is He Saying Those Terrible
yes.
Things About Me? That was probably one of your big breaks, right?
We were playing in a bar and we made a demo tape and it was a song one of the guitar players wrote and Mr. Tambourine Man. And Big in Vegas by Buck Owens and the Buckaroos, just songs
right.
we were playing in the bar. We made a demo of three or four songs, and somebody heard it and got passed us on to the musical director of the movie and
right.
Shel
right.
Silverstein, the renowned cartoonist
yep.
and songwriter. He had written the music for the film. And the great thing for me is I was a big Shel fan when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go to parties. We used to put on these albums, and he had a very strange voice. But he was one of these guys that he'd play this song and break your heart, and the very next song, you'd be rolling on the floor laughing. And it really
yeah.
impressed me. And I one time saw him standing on a street corner in New York, and he looked so gruff because he had a shaved head and a black beard, and he looked so mean. He was actually a sweetie pie. But I stood there for 20 minutes and did not have the nerve to say hello to him, and then he
really?
Wandered. He wandered away with a friend, and I thought, oh, missed opportunity. And somewhere within that next year, these guys brought a tape to us at a rehearsal studio and said, mm-hmm. We want you to learn these two songs. Don't mind the guy's voice. It's very, very strange. Just learn these songs. And
mm-hmm.
he put the tape on, and it was Shel, and I freaked out. And the other guys didn't really know Shel because they were all from down south, and Shel was very much a Chicago, New York kind of entity, but I freaked out, and I couldn't believe I was actually going to get to sing songs that this guy wrote, you know, after not having the nerve to talk to him, you know.
Yeah.
So that
yeah.
Harry Kellerman thing happened, and because of that, because I think CBS Records, Sony after a while, but CBS Records had the soundtrack for that album, for that movie, and
mm-hmm.
we got an audition with the president, and, you know, kind of went in and threw stuff around his dressing room around his office and auditioned. And I'm pretty sure that he signed us just to get rid of us, you know.
Now, the scene was filmed right prior to a Grateful Dead concert. Is that right?
Yes. Actually, you're right. It was at the Fillmore East
right.
In New York City. And,
yep.
and it was on, yes, the Grateful Dead were playing, so they were assured to have a full, very, very happy crowd. And we went on. The only thing that was wrong with it for us is we went on before the Grateful Dead, just about
yeah.
the time all the drugs kicked in, and they went, okay, here comes the Dead. No, here's a bunch of hippies making a movie, you know. And so, but they were nice to us, and you know,
yeah.
we wouldn't have known if they weren't nice to us. We were still, you know, after we filmed that at the Fillmore East, we
right.
went back to the bar in Union City, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and played the theme song of that film to drunks for the next 6 months, introducing it as, here's a little song we recorded for a film, and they would go, shut up, no you didn't, you know, why are you playing here?
That's funny.
So Hook, you know, Hook was all over the place, man. Yeah, but that Harry
yep.
Kellerman movie, that was kind
yep.
of the thing that got somebody to face our way, you know.
I want to remind the audience that the movie would star Dustin Hoffman, Dom DeLuise, Barbara Harris, Jack Warden, David Burns, and Gabriel Dell. I mean, that was a hell of a cast.
It was.
You know?
It was also directed by Ulu Grosbard and written,
yep.
most importantly, by a great writer named Herb Gardner,
mm-hmm.
who also wrote A Thousand Clowns, and he wrote I'm Not Rappaport. I mean,
big plays
that, you know, have been put on all over the world. And we were very, very lucky to be involved. You know, Dustin Hoffman liked us, and, you
yeah.
know, he did the David Frost show, and he insisted that we be on. And again,
oh, cool.
we did the David Frost show and then went back and played in the bar. I mean, we were crossing for a long time. But we were very, very lucky, you know, because
yeah.
we really had to run to keep up with that crowd.
Right.
You know, they'd say,
right.
can you be at the St. Regis Hotel tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.? time, we'd play till 3 a.m. in bars.
Right.
So we'd say, yeah, and we'd show up at 6, 10 after 6, and the crew would breeze in about midday.
Yep.
But we couldn't afford not to be there.
Yep.
You know,
I tell you,
we
had
to show
bands,
up and be sitting on the steps when they showed up, you know.
Bar bands make the best bands, you know, because you guys have had lots of practice. You've been any type of atmosphere, different crowds, you know.
At peril of your life, yes.
Definitely. Well, 72 was definitely a breakout year for the band. Sylvia's Mother was your big hit. That first big hit came out. And, of course, it was followed by Cover of the Rolling Stone, which was huge. And, you know, I watch a lot of the YouTube videos of the band and everything. You guys had a lot of fun together, didn't you?
You know something? We stayed a bar band in our hearts.
Exactly. Yeah,
we stayed
like
a bar band, and we went out and we continued to do what we did. Because when we played in bars, you know, we, like I said, we'd play whatever it took. We'd play dirty versions of hits. You know what I mean? We'd just make rude versions of Proud Mary. You know what I mean? And the bartender didn't care as long as we were on stage 45 minutes, off 15. And back on stage. And you know, the way we used to find out it was time to leave the stage is he would turn the jukebox on. So
really?
We'd be playing or singing or talking, and it would go rolling on a river. And we'd go, okay, we'll be back in 15 minutes. And then we'd be having a drink or talking to somebody, and all of a sudden it would be rolling. We'd rush back.
That's
on stage. Hello, we're back. I mean, nobody would announce us. We would just have to work it out, you know. But no, we stayed a bar band, which is, I think, made it fun for us. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once we started having success and opening for people like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, we found that all very, you know, something to really giggle about, because it was like, what? You know, what are we doing here? You know, and that's, so yeah, the first one, Sylvia's Mother, big hit,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yep.
And I'll tell you what, when that single came out, it pretty quickly got to number 99 in the Hot Billboard Hot 100,
mm-hmm.
and then fell off the charts. And the record label panicked, and we were going, whoa, that was great, because we've been in the top 100, you know what I mean? We had nothing to compare it to. You couldn't bring us down. That wasn't a disappointment. I wasn't in the top 100 last week, you know? So, I mean, we maintain that attitude, and, you know, but then once you start having the success, you got to think about it a little more seriously.
Right. Right.
You know, and we started traveling. We had families. We're away from home a lot. And the one thing you cannot do, man, is you cannot go on radio and TV and complain about a life that most people, without all the knowledge of what it is, wish they had.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to hear you on television going, I can't believe I'm having to go to Australia. You know, because people go, I wish I could go to Australia, and people would clap when I'm done working, and it's true.
Exactly.
So you pretty much have to measure it, you know.
Yeah.
But it got to be a gig. It got to be, and we went from Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show, the hippie bar band, to Dr. Hook Incorporated.
Right. But, you know, I'll be honest with you, Dennis, you sound the same, man. I mean, I was watching you on Shell's Houseboat. Yeah, it's on YouTube. I guess that was some kind of... They were filming that? Was it kind of a special for a show or something?
That was a Scandinavian special.
Is that right? We had gone over
to Scandinavia. Yes. We went to Scandinavia
so
and played the Roskilde Festival. We went and played the Roskilde Festival, and it was in the middle of summer, and everybody was naked. And so when we came out to do our encore, we came out naked. And, you know, the lucky ones were the guitar players, quite honestly. But we came out, and because Scandinavia went, and they put that on TV over there, and the Scandinavian crew went, we're going over there and seeing what these guys do. And we didn't, you know, I think we probably even got naked at the end of that one, because they went, so you get naked at the end of every show, right? And so I don't even get naked at the end of every day, you know?
That's funny.
That was just something we did. But they came over and filmed that show. That houseboat show on Shell's houseboat. That's followed us around. I mean, you know, it was just us standing there in front of Shell's bed. He had a bed there in front of the window, and we did whatever we did. I haven't seen it in a million years.
You guys are hilarious, man. You and Ray, you know, you guys make a good team together.
We did. Ray and I, you know, Ray's 13 years older than me, and near the end of his time in the band, he kind of didn't want to do it anymore. And the hardest thing in the world to do, I'm talking 81, 82,
right.
And then we stayed together and did a few things around the world till 85, and then we did the farewell tour. But Ray was, you know, in his 40s, and he wanted to, you know, he'd been doing it. He was in bands when I was 10, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to do something else. I mean, I don't know what he wanted to do, but he didn't want to do that, and I could tell. And we were all bound to each other. And the hardest thing in the world, man, is to have to be a partner with someone that no longer really wants to do it. Because one, it gets harder, and two, you feel like you're making this guy do this thing, you know,
and he.
He wanted to go, and Ray went, and he went out and he did some R&B stuff, and he did a bunch of stuff for a few years, and then he went back out on the road as Dr. Hook. Mm-hmm. And the unfortunate thing about that, and now we were off the road already, we'd done our farewell tour, but the unfortunate thing about that was that when he left and it all broke up, I kind of maintained the ownership of the name.
Right.
And so Ray came back out as Dr. Hook, and it became my lawyers talking to his lawyers.
Yeah.
And, you know, this escalated in mythology as Ray and I were behind rocks shooting at each other. I hear all the time, oh, so the band ended in acrimony. First of all, the band ended hugging and kissing each other.
Right.
The thing they thought was acrimony was the cursed legalities of stuff.
Because it's
a trademark, man.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just let it lay there, some guy buys it for $100 and it becomes a Subway shop.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
In California, so I maintained the name, and when Ray started to use it again, I had to say, we need to come to some kind of agreement, which we did. And Ray used the name as Dr. Hook featuring Ray Sawyer for, I don't know, 15 years, a long time, and this last year was the end of that. He's stopped, and I have kind of started using the name. Because the one thing I didn't want to do, once I told him he could do it, I really didn't want to go out and be the Battle of Dr. Hooks. I thought it would be unbecoming.
Yep.
There should be one out there.
You sang 95% of the songs anyway, pretty much, right?
Yeah. Well, the popular ones. I mean, there were songs on albums, but yeah. I mean, you know, it's really funny, man, because in the early days, like I said, we had Sylvia's Mother, I sang that. Cover Rolling Stone, it's pretty much Ray's signature thing because he starts singing the song. But then George Cummings sang, I Got a Freaky Old Lady. And it was ensemble.
Yeah.
But then after that, it was Only 16 and a little bit more and If Not You and Share in the Night. And This Is All Me. And that was only because radio recognized my voice and we had a theme. Ray had a recognizable face, but you can't see that on the radio.
Right.
So our theme musically was my voice, and when we went on TV, people would say, "Hey, you see the guy with the eye patch?" And that was working. Those combinations were working.
Yeah.
You know, you remembered what you saw, you remembered what you heard, and that worked. It just worked, and it didn't really cause any problems with Ray and I, like people thought. You know, mm-hmm. but I did. The greatest hits, Dr. Hook greatest hits, I mean, there's 20 songs on there, and I'm singing 17 or 18 of them.
Right.
That's just how it fell, man. That wasn't me elbowing anybody out of the way. And I'll tell you what, nobody was really minding it while we were having hits. You know? Well, it's true. I didn't hear anybody complaining about, we've had another hit, you know?
You know what I admire about the band? I mean, first of all, I consider you guys an eclectic band. You didn't have just one style. You could do just about anything.
But I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, the way you guys transitioned into the disco era, and you went right. You had big hits during the disco era. It's amazing. I would have never thought in a million years Dr. Hook would have been part of that. part of that scene, but you were. You know, some of those songs were definitely, you know, admired by the people that enjoyed disco music.
It was strange, though, man, because after, you know, we went bankrupt. We went bankrupt.
Really?
After, after the first two hits, Sylvia's Mother cover Rolling Stone, we went out there with the big boys, and we were support act for a lot of major acts, like we were saying. And these acts would go in their private planes from Miami to Dallas, and we would get in a rental car and try to drive there, you know, overnight. And then we had to start flying. And we went bankrupt because we simply could not keep touring like that, recording and supporting our families. I mean, we just were not earning enough money to do it. And people see, even that's part of the mythology, too. People go, yeah, so you partied it all away. No. Trust me. We didn't have enough to party with. And then when the band went bankrupt in whatever it was, 75, 76, or something like that, and then we stayed together, and we kept hammering at it. And then we had only 16 from the bankrupt album, and it became a hit, and it kind of started pulling us out there again. And you know, we wanted to now stay on the radio. We wanted to stay on the radio because, like I said to you when we started this interview, that was the only national thread that somebody in California and somebody in Virginia could go, oh, yeah, that sound, that guy, that band. And that was all we had was the radio thing. When I say all we had, it was a big thing. But,
yeah, it was a big thing.
You know, it was that radio day where if you could get WMMS in Cleveland to go on your record, 35 stations would go on it. You know, I remember speaking of WMMS in Cleveland, I remember going there as a bunch of hippies, and there was a brilliant musical director named Rosalie Trombley. Mm-hmm. And she was legendary. She became legendary. I've seen other bands write about her and talk about her. But she was the program director of this station. And she didn't really like us when we were hippies. You know, when I looked like Bigfoot with a guitar, she really wasn't into it that much. And when we put Sharon the Night together, by that time, times have changed and we cleaned it up, you know, and I had a shag haircut, you know, and we went in to that station with Sharon the Night together. And she looked at us and she looked at me and she went, yeah, that's better. And she went on the record. And I thought, you know, geez, a lot of acts are coming in here trying to ply them with cocaine. I just had to get a haircut, you know. This was better than I expected, you know. There was no payola. It was like, yeah, could you trim it on the sides a little bit? Absolutely, you know. I was going that way anyway. So radio kept us alive. But, you know, when we went, Hook was like two bands to a lot of people. We were that early band with the sense of humor and Sylvia's mother, and then we would Sexy Eyes and Better Love Next Time.
Yeah, exactly.
And people will, but you know, people will say to me, Ray, oh, you know, but that's where the band got really, that's where you sold out, and that's where you started, you know, it's like, oh, pardon me, that's where we really got successful. Let me apologize for that one more time.
For making a lot of money at that point.
No, man, and it wasn't even about that. It was about we had endured.
And
our families were okay, and we were a success. And no matter how many times people want to say to me, "Yeah, I liked you better when you were that old bar band," if you listen to the Greatest Hits album, most of them are those ones that people say we sold out on. And had we not had that string of hits, we might have been relegated to. Yeah, I remember them. The novelty act. They had that one weepy song and then that one about the cover of Rolling Stone. I remember them. But we endured. We endured. And I'm proud of that. And, you know, you can say now, this is where what? If you were me, you would have laid down and died and let your family starve and let the band go to hell? No, you wouldn't have. Yeah. You make decisions with tracer bullets going over your head, man. You make them on the spot. And I hate having to apologize for that, you know?
But no, you should. I thought you guys were brilliant. You know, I was a top 40 DJ back in those times, back in 78, 79, 80, when you guys had the string of hits. And, you know, I mean, you fit right in with the playlist, what was going on for the time, you know, sharing the night together. When you're in love with a beautiful woman in 79, which was also recorded, I think, at Muscle Shoals, right? Sound Studio?
Yes. Yeah. Brilliant players. You know,
Better Love
and
Next
that's,
Time.
Yeah. I mean, you wanna have that kind of thing,
yeah.
You know, and those players, that Muscle Shoals thing. See, that's another thing. When we started recording those hits, we were going into the studio and we were recording them with top notch. Killer players.
Right,
I mean, the people who played on When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman are the same musicians that played on, you know, Aretha Franklin's Respect and Kodachrome by Paul Simon. And, you know, as an individual, not as the sharp end of a band or a team player or anything, I always had to sit on the fact that I would go into the studio with the producer and we would cut these records and the band would go home. And I always used to have to sit on that information because I always felt like, well, you know, I don't want to start saying it like I, because I love those guys in the band. They played them every night live. I mean, you know, the records would have meant nothing if we couldn't have gone out and played them. Just these studio guys were brilliant and they were fast. And we would have to go in a studio and cut an album in 2 weeks because we were going somewhere else.
Right.
And so it fell that way. You know, it really just fell that way. But now I'm 67. I'm a singer. I'm representing Dr. Hook. And I want people to know that I recorded hits with the same people that played with Aretha Franklin and Paul Simon.
Yeah.
You know, but I always felt like it was telling tales at a school.
Right.
You know, but then again, the Birds, okay, they're in the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
They didn't play on their own records.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, I know. The Wrecking Crew were amazing, weren't they?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is there are people in the Hall of Fame that have influenced rock and roll that didn't play on their own records. So that's another thing I've stopped apologizing for.
Exactly. I agree with you 100%. You know?
And see, this all comes with perspective, man.
Yeah.
It just comes with perspective. And now it's all about the music. Now it's about, you want to hear Dr. Hook? If you want to see Dr. Hook, then you're going to have to go to YouTube. If you want to hear what Dr. Hook sounded like with the guy who's singing the stuff, then I can give you that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't. And I'm thrilled with that now. I really am thrilled with that because, like I said to you earlier, I really feel like it's my what I should be doing right now. But only because I did, you know, I put out a book of poetry and cartoons. I did some acting. I did this and that. Now I, you know, when I was in Hook, I went from high school to Dr. Hook. You know what I mean? And that's all I knew. I didn't feel very well rounded. I think I even said when we were on the cover of Rolling Stone. Later years, I said, the only thing that was wrong with that for me is I didn't have anything to say. I was 20. I was on the cover of Rolling. What am I, Barack Obama? What was he going to say? You know, I had no idea what to say.
I know.
You know?
You know what's ironic is you live in England, and you actually had two songs that were kind of banned in the beginning, right? Cover of the Rolling Stone because of the... It was commercial. They were advertising. They said it was like advertising the Rolling Stone. And the 16 song, right, was also also banned. Yeah. And you live in England.
The 16 thing has happened much, much later.
Right.
The only 16 happened, you know, it never got banned, it got played. But Cover Rolling Stone, to go back to that one, it was the same thing. You know, the Kinks had that song Lola. And in that song, he sings on the original record just like Coca-Cola. And the BBC said, we can't say Coca-Cola on the radio. That's a brand name.
Mm-hmm.
So we changed it to Cherry Cola. And this was the same thing that because we kept singing Rolling Stone, that they thought we were selling it door to door and hawking subscriptions, I would imagine.
Yeah,
they banned it, but CBS Records, there was a phone number that everybody had where you could call and listen to it, and I thought, ooh, that's very clandestine. I like that. I like that. And now Only 16, when Timeless came out two short years ago, I went up to do some radio, and they said, would you sing a song? And I said, sure. And I was going to sing Only 16, and because of all the nonsense that's gone on lately with over here, there's been all the scandals about people are coming out of the woodwork, and there's just so much sex scandal and stuff that they said to me, oh, you won't be able to sing that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, okay. It breaks my heart. I mean, it's not about, you know, first of all, you're singing about a 16-year-old girl, but you're singing from the perspective of a 16-year-old boy.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a 17-year-old boy. It's not a 50-year-old man singing about a 16-year-old girl. You know what I mean? So they kind of missed the point on that a little bit, you know.
I know.
But those points are easy to miss. Hey,
yeah.
Remember short people? Randy Newman thought, everybody thought Randy Newman hated short people, you know. You got to be careful. You got to be careful.
I know, but they're getting carried away with that. Even young girl, you know, Gary Puckett, I talked to him about young girl. They said the same thing, you know.
Oh, I bet.
Same thing, you know.
I bet. Well, you know, I'm quite honestly, man, you know, it's going to go where it's going to go. And as you get older, nobody gets older and doesn't utter the phrase, why is this happening now?
Right.
It was fine the way it was. But it's, you know, I thought in the old days that, you know, political correctness had its run when shows like All in the Family came on that poked fun at bigotry and racism. And I thought, okay, and everybody saw it. And then there was Richard Pryor. And it really, really did look like it was going to open up and we were going to stop being afraid of words.
Mm-hmm.
And then something slammed shut. You know, now if you say something to someone, you're not saying it about them. You're saying it about them and everyone who looks like them.
I know. Everybody's too touchy nowadays. You know, just relax.
yeah, I know. And what are you going to do? It's what I said to you earlier, man. It's not going to. It's not going to go back.
It's not
going to go back. I mean, you know, politically in America, I don't really know what the hell is going on. It's the strangest thing I've ever seen. But I don't think I'm alone there. You know,
it is strange. Very strange.
I don't think I'm alone there. But you know, like it's man. You get older and you see it change, and you see it change. And you know, the thing that makes me live. Ray, people say, oh, you know, I feel sorry for the young people today. I don't. They're 15, damn it. They don't know. They're not comparing it to, you know what I'm saying? They're dealing with what they got, and they're rocking.
Right.
They're not going, yeah, when I was 13, I could go to the movies for a nickel. I mean, they're not comparing it to anything.
I know.
Please don't feel bad for young people. Encourage them. They're all we have. They may hold the elevator door open as it's slamming shut on our faces, you know?
That's true.
But I don't feel sorry for the young people today. Why would you feel sorry for young people?
Yep.
Pardon me. Our drummer, Aki, when we were in Australia, he had a birthday. And I said to him, how old are you? And he went, oh, man, I'm just turned 47. And I went, oh, shut up. You know, if I was 47, I'd still have 20 years to play with.
I know.
It's just, man, I know they say it's a number, and it is a number. But as you get older, you really do. You just start thinking of it. Like I said to you earlier, you don't go, yeah, dude, I could do that in a couple of years.
Right.
You just don't. And not because you think it's over. I feel very far from Halo and Harp, you know. I really don't. Luck of the draw. I've kind of aged all right. Like when I walk out on stage, nobody goes, who the hell is this? I kind of look like an older version of the same guy, you know. So that's good. But I'll tell you what doesn't do me any favors. Whenever I do a talk show, before they introduce me, they show clips of Hook. So they say,
that does help.
Here's Dennis when he was 20. Here's Dennis when he was 24. Here's Dennis when he was 28. Here's Dennis when he was 30. Here's Dennis when he was 32. And now, here's his dad, you know. And, you know, no matter how well you've aged, you don't go as compared, hey, you look great, but not as compared to what I've just seen. It's just not fair.
Dennis, you look great, man. I'm saying
thank you, man.
From the
thank
bottom
you
of my heart.
I appreciate it.
No, you look great. There's some people that just,
I don't even recognize him anymore.
Hey, man, I look great over the phone. Let's face it. No, it's true. It is the luck of the draw, though, man. I got no secrets. There's nothing I rub on my body and face before I go to bed. I've never been a hard liver.
Right.
Seriously. I know Dr. Hook had that raucous, you know, people used to come to see the band to see if we would make it through the whole show, and it was shambolic, but you know something? None of us were substance abusers. There was never one single minute of rehab in the band.
Yeah.
We were responsible to each other. When you first go on the road, you party. You party because you think it's going to last a minute. As soon as you realize this is your career, you go, oh, I better slow down here. We got five shows in the next four nights, you know? So it tempers itself. But, you know, people say to me all the time, so come on, is it true that Dr. Hook was always stoned? And I say, yeah, just like David Bowie was actually from Mars. You know, part of it, I mean, there was an attitude, and it was the 60s and early 70s, but no, man. I mean, you know, it's like the drunk on the high wire. If he was really drunk, there'd be one show.
Well, hey, Dennis, you're not stoned now, right?
No.
So we'll see. There you
do
go.
I sound
you,
it?
If you're not stoned now, you sound exactly like you did back then, back in the heyday. So that proves your point.
Oh yeah. No, man. You know, believe me, it just slows me down, man. You know, I'm pretty good. It is really the luck of the draw, though. It really
right,
is
right.
the luck of the draw.
You just have a lot of energy.
I feel great, but you know something?
Yep.
When you get older, every day you wake up and you go, I feel really good. And then your brain goes, well, how long do you think that's going to last?
Then you remind yourself how old you are, and then you go, oh, shit.
Well, yeah. You know when I really remind myself of how old I am? When it's 4:30 and I wake up to pee. That's when I really remember.
I know.
And I
know.
Think, don't think, you know.
I know.
And then your
I
brain
know.
Goes, don't think about what? And it's all over, ladies and gentlemen.
I want to talk about a show that you were part of. That was Jim Capaldi, who died in 2005. You did that charity concert, right? You're part of that, and it was Pete Towson, Bill Wyman, who I think is a friend of yours. Did he play in his band for a while?
He is now.
And Steve Winwood, Joe Walsh, Paul Weller, Cat Stevens was in that. Talk about that show. That must be
man,
awesome.
Jim Capaldi was a songwriter and singer and drummer for Traffic, the great group Traffic, with Steve Winwood. And when he passed away, they just did this big, because he was involved in a lot of children's charities, him and his wife. So they did one big thing in London at the Roundhouse. And I got involved in that, and it was really nice. I sang a song or two, and I was in the band. I played harmonica. And, you know, there was a week-long rehearsal for everything, people in and out. And Bill Wyman was the bass player on some of this stuff, so he was there for a day or two. And, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, man. I mean, to be in a room with a Rolling Stone, you know. I went to the Sheraton Hotel. It used to be called the Americana in New York when I was 15 years old, and me and about 25 other teenagers that I didn't know tried to sneak up to the Stones floor, you know. I mean, we were Stones kids and Beatles kids, you know. I rushed up to Bill in my exuberance, and I said, man, because he's got this great band called Bill Wyman's Rhythm Kings.
Good band.
And they're such a good band. They play R&B and they just horns, and it's a killer band because Bill still loves to play. He doesn't love traveling, so he's not in the Stones, but he loves playing. And I said to him, you know, I'd love to come sit in with your band someday. And you know, he kind of looked at me and smiled, and a couple of months later, his guitar player, partner, Terry Taylor, called me and said, Bill wants to know if you still want to do that. And I said, yeah, where do you want me to be? And they sent me a 34-city itinerary. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to go sit in somewhere, but I was in the band.
That's awesome.
And you know what's lovely now, man? You know, first of all, I'm on the tour coach, and I'm sitting in the back, and I look up front, and Bill Wyman's sitting there. And I got to tell you, people would be shocked at how little I've ever wanted in my life. Seriously, seriously. You know, I like when things go full circle. I like when I'm on a bus with Bill Wyman and everybody says to me, don't talk to him about the Stones. He doesn't like to talk about the Stones. Bill used to sit me down voluntarily and tell me about what they were doing backstage at the Ed Sullivan Show. I love, you know, he was so nice to me. And you never want to meet your heroes and find out they're weird or they're terrible.
Exactly.
You really
exactly.
don't. Because there's, oh, man, this whole bits of your record collection you can't play anymore, you
That's
know?
Right. Yeah.
And so Bill was lovely, and I did this couple of months tour with him. And now I can call him a friend of mine. But that Capaldi show, you know, speaking of record collection, that was like being in a band with my record collection. It's Paul
exactly.
Weller, and like you said, Pete Townsend, Bill Wyman, Gary Brooker from Procol Harum. I mean, John Lord from Deep Purple. I mean, Ray Cooper, percussionist, you know. Just everybody, man. Everybody you could want to be in a room with, you know. So it was a really nice... I think they did a DVD and an album of it. I never watch any of that stuff. The only thing I've ever learned from watching myself is don't. Seriously.
That's funny. Yeah, Johnny Depp never watches his movies, and I don't listen to my interviews. I got everything, you know, on DVD, but I never listen to them, and I never read my book, the books that I've written. I've never
right.
went through.
No, man.
Money.
You know, and it's just, it's because, you know, there's nothing to compete with. You do it and you roll ahead, you know.
Yep.
And you did the best. It wouldn't be out. You wouldn't have done it if you weren't happy with it at the time. And we all change our minds about stuff. It's like I said when I was listening to all the Hook tracks. There were things I didn't care for, but they were the same things I didn't care for then.
Yep.
You know, and things have their place and stuff. But no, I tried to watch myself a couple of times. You know, here's something about not even watching myself. We played a club, the Troubadour in Los Angeles, famous club.
Sure.
And we played there for three or four nights. And I used to do this little bass solo thing with our bass player. I would, like, play a bass solo around him. I would play his bass. And this girl came to me on the second night, and she said to me, oh, you know, and you, whenever you do that bass solo thing, you do this really sexy thing. And I said, please don't tell me. And she told me what it was.
Right.
And every night I went on stage, I tried to do that sexy thing. And I don't even know what the heck it was. And it ruined it.
It ruined it.
Absolutely ruined it. Because I thought, and even she came to me and said, you're not doing that anymore. I said, you killed that.
I begged
you not to tell me what it was, because sometimes you don't need, you're in the moment.
Yep,
you know,
exactly.
You're in the moment. Once in a while, I will listen. If I'm going to do a lot of interviews for a tour, like I have a UK tour coming up,
right.
and I've been doing a lot of stuff. If I'm going to do a lot of interviews, I may listen to one of them.
Right.
In the early, just to see if I'm a moron, to see if I'm hitting all the salient points. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But for the most part, man, I mean, I think you can pretty much tell from the minute we both got on the phone that I'm not reading any of this. You know?
No, man, you're great. You're a great interview. You know? I hate
well,
when
no
somebody
dead air. No dead air anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I don't like the dead air thing. I hate it when somebody responds with three words and it just stops.
Yeah, don't you love it when the question is longer? Me, you say, how you doing, Dennis? And then 10 minutes later you ask me the first question, you know. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
That's just man, I gotta tell you though, man, if I was not still enthusiastic about this, if I still didn't think to myself that after 100 years somebody still wants to talk to me about stuff, then I wouldn't waste your time. I really wouldn't waste your time giving you one-word answers and stuff.
Yep,
I wouldn't waste my time. I mean, it's not worth anything. For me, singing, acting, writing, talking to you, it's all about communicating with other people.
I
like other people. Sometimes I don't. But for the most part, I like the thought of there being other people.
Exactly.
I tell you what I really like the thought of. I like that I'm being spoken to rather than about this year.
Right.
While we've lost so many so many people, you know. But I see, there's not a mystery there either, Ray. It's baby boomers, man.
Yeah,
it's baby boomers. You know, in the old days, somebody would be a star till they were about 40, and then they'd do a couple of films or something, and then they'd kind of fade away, and you'd see a picture of them shopping in sunglasses when they were in their 60s, and then one day you'd read they were dead. Baby boomers are still leaping off amplifiers. Mick Jagger is 75. He's still negotiating a stage in a stadium. If Mick Jagger goes, somebody's going to go, not going to say, what happened to Mick Jagger? They're going to go, I just saw him. Played to 30,000 people three nights ago. We don't stop now. Baby boomers made it very evident that we were not going to give up. We were going to dance right to the precipice.
Yep, thank God for that. Thank God for that, man. I just want to mention...
If you don't have to stop, if you don't have to stop, I mean, if it ever feels unbecoming, I'll pack it in.
Yeah, I talked to Paul Kattner, and he said he would probably die on stage. So he practically almost did that, you know. So,
And you know, and then again, on the other end of that, Mick Jagger, when he was about 24, said he's not going to be shaking his butt up on stage singing Satisfaction at 30.
Exactly.
And Pete Townsend said, I hope I die before I get old.
Right.
Would you like to rethink that?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Because when you're 15, 16, 17, however life is how you think it's going to be forever. And the only advice I can ever give younger people is however you think it's going to be, it probably isn't going to be. So just leave some wiggle room here. Because you're always going to be disappointed. Me, I don't believe anything happens for a reason. I think it's a bunch of random events, and we give it structure in our brains because we have to live. But still, I'm always disappointed when something doesn't happen the way I thought it was going to happen. And that's silly because I didn't think it was going to happen anyway. It's not about that, you know. But that's life and, you know, whatever. I really hope I could get this band to come play in the States. I hope so, too. You know?
And don't forget Florida. I'm in Florida, and we broadcast from California. So, you know, I'm hoping you come to Florida.
You're in Florida, and you broadcast in California? From where?
We broadcast from California, right? But I'm in Florida.
Well, there you go, though. So I sort of set myself on fire in Florida, and they'll smell smoke in California. So I almost did what I said. It was pretty cool.
All over the world, really. We broadcast worldwide, so you're in good shape.
Oh, man, good. That's good. No, that's great. Yeah. That's great, man, because, you know, if you're going to still be doing this, you might as well have people know. So this is really valuable to me, Ray. I appreciate it a lot.
Dennis, what about another album? Do you have anything in the works, or what are you thinking about?
In my head, I do. Yeah, you know, it's a strange climate. When you hear people like Roger Daltrey say, the Who's not going to put out another album? Nobody brings albums anymore.
Right.
It makes you wonder. Because I would love nothing more than to put out another Hook album. Mm-hmm. But I don't want it to just be a personal vanity, quite honestly. If I put out another Hook album, I'd like people to hear it. So it's a matter of that. Well, who puts it out? How much control you have over it? You know, it's a lot of things. It's such a strange game now, man. And I've never been. You know, I've always been a hippie. I mean, I've tried to be somewhat of a businessman, but I'm not going to sit in my room with an abacus. You know what I mean? It's a little more organic than that. So, but definitely now that Hook. The brand of Hook has gotten a little attention here because I've been taking it around the world. I'm definitely thinking about you know, trying to do a Hook album. But see, that's the tricky thing, too. Whenever you have success with something, you have your original success by doing something you felt was right, and then you try to recapture that so many times that you want to kill yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when we had our first record, Sylvia's Mother. After we had Sylvia's Mother, which Shel Silverstein wrote, we used to get pitched songs. Okay, here's one about my aunt. Here's one about my Uncle Frank. You know what I mean? It's like, we're not just doing relative songs.
Yeah, that's funny.
And that you really can, you know, when you write songs, and as soon as somebody goes, wow, that sounds like a Dennis LaCourier song, you start trying to write like Dennis LaCourier. And it's, you know what I mean? You are Dennis LaCourier. It's like trying to look like me, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's strange. But no, I am definitely, you know, so yeah, there's something working in my head. I'm writing some. I'm looking for songs. I'm even looking at artists that I like, you know what I mean, and thinking that maybe I should do one of their songs and stuff, because it's wide open. But I think, yeah, I'd love Hook to have a presence again, man, you know, because the one thing I'm proudest of Hook is that the music still has this, I mean, people apply it to their own lives, and, you know, I run into people and they're telling me, before they even say hello to me, they tell me, oh, I used to go camping with my family, and we sang Dr. Hook songs all the way in the car. And, you know, my dad loved you guys, and he's passed away recently, and we're all going to come to the show. And you're right in the middle of their lives. Yeah. And it's not easily dismissed. Even on a bad day when you don't want to know anybody, somebody starts talking to you about how much something you did meant to them. It's really, really hard to just, you know, give them a dirty look. I mean, you really need to engage with that. And, you know, you're lucky. You're lucky that you're part of somebody's soundtrack like that.
Well, people timeline their lives with music. I certainly
sure.
do, you know. I think that's awesome. I really do.
You know, but I'll tell you what. So do I, and I'm a big Beatles fan, and I listen to that stuff all the time. And,
right.
and I have a lot of favorite music. But, you know, I also am the guy that knows when Paul McCartney puts out a new album.
Yep.
And I like it when he puts out a new album, because I've always loved him, and I trust him, and I know there will be something, if not everything, on this new album that I will cherish. And it always makes me wonder, when you've had a history, like Hook, and you put out a solo album, and people go, oh, I love you, this band, and you say, have you ever heard my song? Oh, no, I didn't know you had one out. Now, some of that is marketing, because, you know, I'm not on EMI anymore.
Right.
I put
right.
out stuff on independent labels.
Yep.
But it makes you wonder, say, well, why don't you take a listen to my new album? Because you might really like it. Because for me, I want to know what Paul McCartney's still thinking.
Sure.
I want to know what Bob Dylan still, you know, I don't just go, yeah, well, I love that Mr. Tambourine Man, that's all I need to know. And I realize some people don't plug into music like that, but I often wonder where it is that they stop trusting you. And I think it's probably when they all have kids and they all go out and they start having their own lives. Because that's what happens to your music, too, is families and kids that like your music. And then later on, they go out and they have lives. And maybe they don't think about you again until they're in their mid-30s and their kids are a little bit older.
Yeah.
And then they go, oh, there's a guy from Dr. Hook. He's still alive. Maybe we should go check him out, you know?
I like to see you put out an album and bring in some special guests. You know, maybe bring in Bill Wyman and some of those guys.
I know what you mean. I thought about it. I thought, you know, but a lot of it's going through my mind right now, you know. But now I got this UK tour coming up in from September to December, and then might be going back to New Zealand and Australia. I don't know. And always, man, we've talked to people about the States, and we're still talking to people about the States, because it just seems like, you know, it just seems silly if I don't go back. But like I said, it's hard to do an American tour such, you know. And no matter where I play, somebody will go, oh, so what's wrong with Pittsburgh? Nothing is wrong with Pittsburgh. I mean, you know, I mean, that's the risk that you run, is that, you know, wherever you do play, that means you didn't play somewhere else. So I don't know. You probably have to do it in pieces and pieces and pieces, but then you have to keep your band away from home forever and stuff like that. It's just tough. But I want everybody in the States to know that I haven't just, like, walked away. I'm an American. Right. Still pay taxes there. And I would love to come back and sing these songs that, you know, I mean, started there, you know.
Dennis LaCourier is alive
and well.
I miss
Saturday Night Live, and I miss the Four Seasons. I mean, I don't mean Frankie Valli. I mean, I miss spring, summer, fall, winter.
Right.
I don't see those anymore. You could set your watch by them when I grew up in New York.
Dennis, I want to thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. You know,
thanks,
you,
man. Hey, really, we did this whole interview. Wow, far out.
You've given us so much great music, and you continue to give us great music. I want to wish you the best of luck on the tour, which is very successful. I saw all the sold out dates. You know,
yeah, it's doing
awesome.
All right. It's doing okay,
yeah.
Man. It's nice.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice. I mean, you know, and it's nice. It makes my life simpler when I go out and I know there's going to be people there and people
yeah.
who like what I'm about to play.
It's a
nice. We should all have those kind of problems. My biggest problem on this tour is what songs to leave out.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, so. Yeah.
Well, that's a good
thank
problem.
Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it, man. I know I talk a lot and I laugh about goofy stuff, but thank you very
Dennis,
much.
Dennis, you've been great,
listening.
Man. It's so nice to hear somebody that hasn't changed from 30 and 40 years ago. You know, you haven't changed a bit, man. You sound great.
I'm checking my pulse, and as soon as I get off the phone, I'm going to check my reflection and make sure I still have one.
Okay, good. Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you, my friend. Listen, you know where I am now. You got my number. Anything comes up, you're doing a Christmas raffle or something, let me know. I'm around.
I appreciate it. We'll get you back on the air again to see what you're doing in the near future. How's that?
Okay, yeah. Keep. Yeah. Let's do the six-month checkup.
There you go. We'll do a six-month checkup.
Okay. Thank you, my friend.
All right, Dennis. Take care, man.
Bye-bye.
Visit the official Dennis LeCourriere website at www.dennislecourriere.com for all the latest band news and concert dates. Also, visit the band on Facebook at www.facebook.com/DrHookOfficial or on Twitter at https://twitter.com/DrHookOfficial. Very special thanks to Adrian at Night Owl Productions in the UK for arranging this interview today. Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions you would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans, we shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio, Station 1.